the Netherlands, a system called dynamic governance has been used to run a range of organisations, from a police department to a Buddhist monastery, with good results. Dynamic governance has a long history of theory behind it. It's called sociocracy in the Netherlands, elsewhere green governance, but it's designed to tackle the problem of how to engage all parties, all stakeholders, workers and bosses and investors in an organisation harmoniously, how to make it more truly democratic. So in the Netherlands in the 1970s, Gerhard Endenburg developed the principles of sociocracy or dynamic governance in his electrical engineering firm. And it seemed to take off not only in the Netherlands but elsewhere. John Buck is in New Zealand to run workshops about it. He's chief executive of Governance Alive, co-author of a book called We the People, Consenting to a Deeper Democracy. And he joins me now in our Christchurch studio. Morning, John.
Good morning.
Is this applicable beyond an organisation to a larger sphere such as a town or a country? Let's see how far it goes.
Yes. That's kind of the leading edge of the technology, is how to apply it to a whole community.
And you call it technology. What is it? Is it a philosophy?
It's a methodology. If it's anything, it's engineering.
Engineering. Can you explain?
Mm-hmm. It comes out of the science of cybernetics, which is the science of steering and control.
And tell me what it does in order to improve what we would regard as a flawed democracy at the moment.
It creates structures where people can get together and talk about how things are going. It creates structures where people can sit back and sharpen the saw, think about how things are going, and then go out and try some more.
And what are the benefits?
You end up over time with a more elegant structure, more elegant operation, people being happy. There's a certain grace to the organizations.
Elegance and grace sound very nice. Can you be more specific about how you achieve that?
Let me give the example of AdScale. Manfred Friedrich has me down here. He's the chief technology officer of AdScale, and they use a programming process called agile programming that has many of the elements of dynamic governance in it. They work for 3 weeks, they sit and think for a couple of hours about how that went, and then they go and they start a new assignment. It's called, in agile programming technology, that's called a scrum. And dynamic governance does more or less the same thing. It has people working for a while and then sitting down and saying, gee, how did that go? And let's set some policy all together about how we want to go next.
As I've read about it, one of the things that strikes me is the expression consent and not consensus. Can you explain that?
I can use an analogy. You can't make a consensus decision with your automobile. I don't know of anybody who gets in their automobile and says, do you think we should go and get milk for the baby? You'd simply get in the car and you go off down the road. The car, however, can make a consent decision with you. It can tell you that it has a flat tire, you hear a bump, 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 or maybe a little red light comes on the dashboard and says, by the way, I'm out of oil. And then you need to do something about it. You, in essence, are a baby milk-getting system, you in the car, and you have to solve the problem. So that the car has withdrawn its consent, it can do that, but it can't agree with you, which is consensus.
So how do you achieve that consent?
By following some specific processes.
And the processes, I don't know how complicated we need get here, but mm-hmm. It relies a lot on the theory of self-organization.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Well, to self-organize, you need to have some chaos and you need to have a common energy pushing you, which can be a common aim, a product or service you're trying to produce. And as long as you have that, then everybody in the circle or in the group will self-organize. So our procedures start with some chaos and then have people have the opportunity to listen to each other, and then their ideas self-organize. And as long as the resulting proposal is within everybody's range of tolerance, then you go with it.
Given that you don't regard majority vote as truly democratic, how would a meeting work without what we assume is the only way that something can be decided, i.e. by majority vote?
The majority vote has pluses and minuses. It can get things done very quickly. It can be decisive, sort of, unless you're the U.S. Congress. And it's fairly clear. There's specific procedures like Robert's Rules of Order in the U.S. So everything has a plus and a minus. You're much better off if you have a common aim to say, can everybody live with this solution? And you go around the circle formally, you know, do you have any paramount objection to this? No. Do you? And so forth.
What's a paramount objection? I mean, what would a not paramount objection be?
One that didn't really mean much. It's like trivial.
But who decides whether it's trivial?
The person who's making the statement uses that as a measurement stick. Is this something like that's twisting my gut and I just really can't go along with it? I can't help toward the common aim if we do this.
I don't think I'm being frivolous to suggest that some people's trivial objection in the eyes of others is paramount to them.
Right. And it doesn't matter, really. It's a guideline. And anybody who has any uncomfortable feeling, you want to know it because they probably see something that everybody else doesn't see.
Right.
If I'm facilitating and I go around a circle and somebody says, I don't have an objection, and they have their arms crossed and they're looking down, I say, there is an objection here. Let's find out what that is after we've been around.
And who's in charge?
You have an elected facilitator. The circle elects somebody to run the meeting.
And so they would need to be trained, would
yes,
they not?
Yes, that's the big downside of dynamic governance, is you need training. Yeah.
Because it's a very subtle thing to be. You need to be able to, as you've described it, you need to be able to read body language.
It does build communication skills, and you can do it, you know, sort of in a not very skilled way, just like you can ski down a mountain without much skill if you're on the beginner's trail, and then you can get very good at it. So there's a whole range.
So as it's working, say, in the Netherlands, what kind of training takes place?
The Sociocratic Center there provides lots of training. They have certified consultants who also provide training.
Sociocratic Center?
Yes.
What does that do, a Sociocratic Center? Is it an institution? How widely
yes.
subscribed to is it?
Oh, I don't know that it's that widely subscribed. There is a political party in Holland that uses it, but it's not one that has any seats in Parliament yet. It's close. That started up 2 years ago. It's known among some people, so I can't say that it's a broad, you know, great rolling avalanche of a movement.
Give me a bit of a background on you.
I probably have most recent managerial experience before I started my consulting company was as a manager in software installation, software project management. I managed a contract with about 200 people putting computers in U.S. embassies around the world for about 10 years. And so I've had lots of computer in my background. I had always had the feeling that there had to be a better way to run an organization. I used to think, if I can vote for the mayor, why can't I vote for my boss? And spent a number of years sort of looking, researching in the background, looking for somebody who had figured out how to organize a company that had democratic values but was a really good business organization also. And I rejected a lot of things I looked at, and then finally I ran across Gerard Endenburg in the Netherlands, and I'd done enough research to say, ha, there's something new here.
And so you got together with him, and I know you've written a book with him and many articles.
Mm-hmm. And so finally I said, well, you know, you're getting, people are coming to you for this work rather than your computer management work. Why don't you try going off and consulting? And that's what I've been doing. I have a number of people that I'm mentoring, and some of us are forming an even larger business. At the moment, we're in several countries, and so it's all very exciting to see things unfolding.
So does he still run an engineering, electrical engineering company?
He purposely pulled back from that. The company was started out as a management experiment. It's still an ongoing company today, but he wanted to see what would happen when he left it.
And what did happen?
Which he's done. It's continued on sociocratically. I think it's two managers down the line from what him being there, and it's the basic structure is holding, and so that's a good piece of data.
And do people vote on the boss?
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm.
How does that work? Like anybody could be in charge, depending on the vote, but not a majority vote, presumably.
And it's not a vote exactly. People have a voice in it, and that's different than voting. And so, the structure makes sure all voices are heard. Investors. They're very important. People working in the company, they're important. People from the local environment, government, the social part of the environment, all need to have a voice in who this person is. So you structure it so that all voices are considered.
I read an interesting account of a meeting in which something or someone is chosen, and everybody in the circle had to say who they wanted and why. So mm-hmm. there was, you know, lots of positive statements. But when you get to the end of that and you have, you know, like five names, mm-hmm. how do you whittle it down to one without anybody feeling aggrieved?
Right. You listen to the arguments and then you propose somebody who seems to have good arguments, and you all know beforehand that you won't find the perfect candidate. It's always more or less
a compromise.
The person has a specific term. The feeling, it's every time I've seen it, is one of celebration. There's not winners and losers, which is a really nice difference from majority vote.
Oh, goodness. Don't you ever have intractable people? You know, it all sounds lovely, elegance and grace and light and harmony, but mm-hmm. don't you ever get, you know, the difficult one? Who won't,
absolutely.
Who cannot.
Yes.
What do you do with those people?
They, over time, they either...
over time. What happens?
Over time, yeah, when you first start with dynamic governance is when your most difficult facilitations are, because you have to get the process going. If somebody just is not aligned with the common aim, then there's a process for removing them, separating them from the circle. But if the common alignment's there, sometimes those difficult people are your most valuable. They stimulate you to greater creativity than you would ever get without listening to them. It's the instinct is like, oh, that difficult person, I don't want to listen to them. But the growth you get from the listening is makes it so that the manager day-to-day is not managing but steering creativity. That's a sort of a measure of elegance when they start saying that.
There would be a number limit to this, right? I mean, it sounds like the idea of it is that everybody is joined by a common goal of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't have too many people engaged in a common goal, can you?
The largest organizations that are using this are about 2,000 people.
And this would be what kind of organization?
There's an agriculture business in Brazil called Terra Viva. There's a home care nursing organization in Holland with about 2,000 also. It varies. It doesn't matter what the organization is. What matters is how you're structuring the power. And what you do is everybody who has a small common aim, like say the accounting department or the tulip bulb department down there in Terra Viva, is a circle, and then there's a way of linking the circles upward to up the ladder, and at each level, then you have a smaller group that's operating.
And so, if it were to work on a national basis, say, it would take a long time, but you would have lots and lots of intersecting circles.
Yes.
I mean, can you imagine that working?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yep. There are various things going on experimenting with that. There's a town in Quebec in Canada that has a grant from the provincial government called Tresson Redempteur that is experimenting with running the whole town socratically. There's experiments going on in Rotterdam and Woerden in Holland. And there's also actually some things happening in India that I can't quite understand because I try to talk to them. I can't understand the accents.
Right.
And there's other smaller...
You get by all right in the Netherlands, though.
Yes.
You don't...
Yeah, more or less. I can understand it a little bit, but when I open my mouth, they laugh.
Huh. Well, that must break the ice, then. What do unions, what do trade unions say about this system?
In Holland, the Endenburg Electrotechnique has gotten awards of recognition and appreciation from both management organizations, like the equivalent of the Chamber of Commerce, as well as some of the unions, because it seems to be healing for the tension that often exists between management and union.
Yeah. I mean, it could be regarded as a way of disempowering unions if one were accustomed to dealing in that kind of environment. Have you ever had that response?
Yeah, it might change the role of the union, but yeah. the voice of the union is another one of the stakeholders that's very important.
So how many stakeholders would you need to accommodate if you were running even a town on this basis? I mean, what's the maximum number of, as it were, stakeholders?
Well, I'll tell you, I would love to see Christchurch look at this. I've been talking with some of the people, particularly like over in Sumner, who have spontaneously organized and are doing wonderful work and are in a cooperative relationship with the government. And there's all sorts of opportunities to create a larger we, and I would love to see some experimentation like that happen. The earthquake and all the trauma from that provides a wonderful opportunity for it. And so if you have neighborhoods, that's one set of stakeholders. You can organize those to connect with the government as a kind of up the ladder in levels of stakeholders. You've got the financial community. Manfred Friedrich wants a harmonious community for his business. That's good for business. So you have businesses in there. And when you really look at it, you've got probably four major segments of any stakeholders. You've got financial, you've got government, you've got cultural, and you've got the kind of business or economic aim of a neighborhood or a community. And so you just simply organize those to bring their different thoughts in.
Because the point is to try to engage people who have something in common. I read an article that you...
Common aim.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I read an article that you and Jared Endenburg wrote, The Creative Forces of Self-Organization, in which you explained that sociocracy is literally ruled by the socios, people who have a social relationship with each other, whereas a democracy is ruled by the masses, the demos, who may have little in common.
Right.
I'm imagining that a homogenous society is easier to run along these lines.
That's an interesting question. I think that you actually don't want one that's all the same. You want the differences. Out of differences come growth and creativity. And so it needs to reflect what's there. If you have a homogenous society, fine. If it's a lot of different people, then bring them together.
In New Zealand, we have an observable increasing gap between the very highly paid and the rest.
Mm-hmm.
If the system were in place in a corporation in which the head is currently earning millions, then he or she would not anymore, presumably. In other words, if you were the head of a corporation earning truckloads of money, why would you want to engage in the system?
If you're the top leader, you want a system that's smarter than you are. And this lets you construct one that is.
Do you really?
Yes.
You should.
Yes, you do.
But do you?
If your motivation is some sort of sociopathic manipulation of people and that's you know, all that's in there for you, then you're likely to have an organization that you can feel like, oh, I'm pushing it around, but it's going to fail after a while because you'll end up with dispirited people. And the organization, if I'm thinking of the book Good to Great, the organizations that really work well have the leader who's not into his ego, he's into getting everybody to work well together. And this promotes that kind of leadership.
And so if you have a corporation where the boss is earning gazillions, he or she might not remain the boss.
Maybe, maybe not. You have to ask why. Why is the person earning so much? It may be that you need the kind of skills that you can only get paying that much. Mm. Maybe there's a good reason for it.
Well,
maybe
that's
not.
That's the debate, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is.
And it seems to me that the forces against sociocracy would be powerful and moneyed.
Yeah, it's possible. And we have to see how that develops. In theory, over time, the cooperative organizations are going to be stronger than the ones that are operating only out of a power over basis.
Yes. We're talking about the next millennium, really, aren't we here? When it's going to take over the world?
I don't know if taking over the world is a goal. Certainly a society that's fun to live in and creative and people are loving living there is much more achievable in the next millennium.
And, well, good luck for that. Nice to talk to you, John Buck.